awful.
Yeah. Yeah. Terrible thing that happened to her. So Mary, she's doing this. She's boarding this coffin ship after terrible circumstances in Ireland, her home.
Right.
She's missing her home anyway as she's going. And she wants to look for her dad. Is that how you say it?
Her father had left the family in Ireland, as many Irishmen did during the famine, to go to Boston to try to earn money to send back to bring his family over to Boston. The money was probably sent to the landlord of Mary's cottage, which, you know, that was like throwing it down the rabbit hole, because they just took it. And as the Irish were unable to produce their quota of grain to be shipped over to England, or wool from the sheep, or meat, you know, then the landlords would burn the cottages. They were just huts with, you know, thatch roofs, and they would burn the cottages. And that's what happened to Mary and her mother and her baby sister while the father was away, of course, without his knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Terrible, terrible, tragic circumstances.
It was.
So she has a lot of adventures on the ship. She meets her best friend, Kamua Okafor. Did I say that right?
Kamua Okafor, yeah.
Okay.
Kamua Okafor. He is an African slave boy in the crew cabin, and she's never seen a black person in her life. There are none in Ireland, or there were none in Ireland. There are now. But he is the son of a witch doctor, and he's a brilliant, brilliant young man. Both kids are illiterate, but he's brilliant. And he saves her from the sailors after her violation. And the two of them hide in the ship for the entire trip over. And it takes her a long time to trust him after what's happened to her. You know, her trust has been violated by everyone. And so it takes her a long time to trust him, but finally she does trust him, and they become like a soul brother and sister for the rest of the book.
Yeah, yeah. And so they make it to Boston after all these adventures they have. And so for Ireland, your sketches of Ireland and your details about Boston, you did a lot of research.
Oh, yeah.
In the U.S. and you, as you said, in Ireland.
Yes.
Can you talk about that, your process? Where did you go? Who did you talk to?
Well, in Ireland, it's a lot about just talking to the people. However, we did go to Cove, which is spelled C-O-B-H. Cove is the Cork Harbor. It literally means cove, and it's a big harbor now. It's, although it doesn't look big, but this cove was the last port that the Titanic sailed from. And so anyway, the Cove Harbor during the time of the famine was actually named Queenstown after, Queen Victoria. When the Irish declared their independence in 1922, one of the first things they did was to rename that harbor Cove, C-O-B-H, Cove, after, you know, in the Gaelic, what it was meant to be. Because they resented the British, there's no question. They had good reason to. And so anyway, we went to that harbor. We went to the Cove Harbor. And, oh, my gosh, they have a replica of a coffin ship that you can walk into, and it becomes very dark, and it moves, and I don't know if it moves or if they've just got ways to make you feel like it moves, and you hear the waves, and you hear the people, you know, crying, and they project on the walls of this coffin ship pictures of the people who were on those ships. And I just lost it. Mm-hmm. I got so emotional mm-hmm. there and wept, you know. It was really moving. And so I did that. And then I went to the Cove Museum, and I talked to a lot of the people who, you know, had all the historical stuff about that area. And they were so helpful. I mean, like, for instance, I had at one point something about she got a sandwich in a restaurant. They're like, there were no restaurants then. It was nothing like that. You know, it's just, you think of things in terms of the way they are now, and they didn't exist like that back then. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just a very different world. Mm-hmm. And I have credited, you know, some of those people. I had to thank an awful lot of folks in the final analysis, because I just, you know, these people were so wonderful. It was tough in Boston, believe it or not, to find a lot of historical data on that time. Boston is more, you know, the Revolutionary War. That's their shtick. Mm-hmm. It's not when the Irish were coming over. It's not during that time, you know, just before the Civil War. This was like 1849, and Civil War broke in 1862. So you don't get a lot of information in Boston about that time period, strangely enough. However, we did interview a young man who he's in charge of all the history for the USS Constitutional, Old Ironsides. He was wonderful, and he told me what the streets were like, and he told me, you know, all kinds of things about what the time period would be like in Boston. Mm-hmm. So he was great. But frankly, to find out about, like, what the people were wearing and what their firearms were all about and everything, we went to Charleston, because Charleston is the Civil War, you know. It's a Revolutionary War too, but it had a lot more about that time period than did Boston.
I wonder if that's, you mentioned the, I don't know how to say it, Nina, which was no Irish need apply.
Oh yeah.
Which that was all over
very
Boston.
Very common in Boston.
I wonder if that's why there isn't a lot of information, that there was so much prejudice that people just didn't even write about it.
That's probably true. Yeah, it's probably true. You know, although Boston was the seat of abolition, you know, I mean, that was, they were very progressive in some ways, mm-hmm. but not toward the Irish.
That is just so odd. People are so strange. It's like we pick a group for some reason that we decide, I'm not going to like these people because, you
right.
know, whatever reason, silly right. reason, and what you just said, it just sounds so crazy.
I know.
Okay, they didn't like the Irish, but they were trying to free the slaves, the black people.
That's right.
But what you brought out also in the book is how prejudiced people were in Boston at the time against black people as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was shortly after this country set up something called the Fugitive Slave Act, and Kamua is a victim of that almost, and that is sort of like, if you saw a black man on the street, and if you, you know, you could get him into a train and get him down south, then, you know, they would take him, and he was mm-hmm. a slave. And, well, 12 years a slave. You saw that, probably. And that was a wonderful musician, I think in New York, not in Boston. And, I mean, he was a classically trained musician, but they just grabbed him off the street and threw him on a train and sent him down south, and he was a slave.
It's awful.
So that's how it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a very mixed, you know, message.
Perilous.
And that's why, like, Kamua, who, he got a job in Boston before Mary did, and people questioned that. How could that happen? But he went to work for an extremely progressive Jewish man who owned an apothecary. And this guy was sharp enough to say, you know, those folks up on Beacon Hill, if I have a delivery boy who's black and all that, that's gonna, they're gonna like that. So it was an interesting time, I think. Yeah, as far as I could tell.
I'm sure it was very interesting. Besides everything else it was.
Yeah.
So, Shanty Gold started out as a four-generational novel, Daughters of Famine, but you broke it up into several stories, the first being Shanty Gold.
Correct.
Because it was very, very long, right?
It was 800 pages.
Yeah, right.
As a first-time writer, you're not going to get an agent nor a publisher for 800 pages.
No.
So, yeah, and good writers, a lot of writers would read it, and they would advise me, and they said, each one of these women deserves her own story. So, yes, Shanty Gold is the first of a trilogy. The second book is called Lace Curtain, and it's almost finished. I promised my agent I would get a tour in March. I'm not going to make it because I've got some carpal tunnel stuff going on. Mm-hmm. But she's good. She understands this. But the second book is about Nellie Kelly, who is Mary Boland's daughter.
Ah.
Starts out, yeah, with her at the same age. Both of them are 13 years old when the books start. And I'm interested, as you know, you read Shanty Gold. Shanty Gold ends on a high note.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Mary Boland has overcome every kind of thing that could happen. But my research indicated, like in 1870, which is when the next book starts, things were really rough on women back then.
Mm-hmm.
They were really rough on them. And I'm not going to give too much away, but I don't think that Nellie Kelly is going to have as happy an ending as did Mary Boland, sadly.
Oh, my.
Lace Curtain, yeah.
My.
Yeah.
I know Mary Boland is very gung-ho. She's very strong.
Very strong woman.
It just seems like no matter what happens, she just picks herself up and keeps going.
She does.
And there's a lot of stuff that happens to her.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
There sure is. Yeah, she does. She's a survivor of the First Order.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that is very typical of Irish women. They are very strong women. It's a very matriarchal society. Sadly, because a lot of men are drinking too much.
Yeah, it's too bad.
I know. But the women are tough.
Yeah.
And I saw that in my family. I see it in myself. I see it in my daughters.
Mm-hmm.
They're tough women.
Well, this is good.
This is very good.
This is good.
Yeah.
So, will you read some for us from Shanty Gold and maybe give us just a little bit of background about what you're reading? And Matt, I think, is going to
turn on
a little bit of music.
And we're going to have a little music under me because you can't have St. Patrick's Day, and that's tomorrow, without some music.
Yeah.
So anyway, what's happening here